Dobré dopoledne. We have to start the other part of conference. I would like to panelist Tune Kelam, please. Paní Ivana Janů, prosím.
Dobrý den.
Alexandra Mihalčea, Mr. Sandy, and Boris Burgard is here. So Ms. Mihalčea is not here. So please, the rest of the panelists. And we can start the next panel. Takže ještě jednou dobré dopoledne, vítejte v dalším panelu naší konference. Doufejme, že, nebo já doufám, že panel bude nejméně tak zajímavý, jako byl ten předchozí. A dovolte mi, abych přivítal tentokrát v češtině naše panelisty. Člen Evropského parlamentu a bývalý disident Tune Kelam z Estonska bude moderátorem, hned co mu předám slovo. Welcome in Prague. Právník, člen Jihoafrické komise pro usmíření a porozumění, pan Tsiki Sandi, který přiletěl do slova před několika hodinami. Jenom bych podotknul, že je to poprvé v České republice, kdy se někdo z této komise, z tohoto výboru pro vyšetřování zločinu apartheidu, představuje v České republice, takže je nám velkou ctí, že můžeme přivítat pana Sandyho v Praze. Přeskočil jsem jednu dámu, tu si záměrně nechávám na konec, takže to není nezdvořilost. Potom další zahraniční host, pan Burkhardt z Německa. A jsme velmi rádi, že zde máme zastoupení také v podobě soudkyně Ústavního soudu České republiky a tou dámou mezi námi je Ivana Janů, takže vítejte v Praze. A nyní poprosím pana Kelama, aby se ujal své role moderátora panelu.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience. And we'll continue our debates because the solution is still not in sight. We can anticipate some solutions. But first of all, let me read you a draft of a citizens' initiative, and our friend Jörn Lindblad has kindly taken responsibility for this initiative, and he is going to gather signatures. This is a draft statement, and I read you the text. We, the undersigned, and the institutions we represent, express our grave concern about recent events in the Czech Republic and Romania, two weakened institutions dedicated to the investigation and exposure of crimes of communism, namely the Institute for the Study of Totalitarian Regimes and the Institute for the Investigation of Communist Crimes and the Memory of Romanian Exile. We believe these institutions and their activities must be strengthened and supported to ensure that the crimes of communism are condemned and their perpetrators brought to justice. These institutions are essential to draw the lessons necessary to prevent similar or new totalitarian regimes in the future. We also regard it utterly important to raise the awareness and knowledge about the atrocities that took place in the name of communism in Europe, as well as those still taking place in countries where communism is at large. And we agreed also we have got technical problems in making copies of the draft text. And so Jörn Lindblad will have the only authentic copy, let us say, three. The third one is here. But let me mention that we agreed to add also a sentence that these institutions should be independent of changes on the political scene in respective countries. We welcome very much the Czech Prime Minister's statement this morning. and his promised support for the Czech Institute. And we very much hope that the leadership of the Institute too will continue and will not be changed. But in any way, this is an invitation to you to add your signatures if you consider it possible, and then we can prepare the final text at the end of our deliberations. Thank you. And now the topic of this panel is to look for examples how justice could be brought about. We have very valuable experience from different areas of the world, especially from the former Yugoslav Republic, from Rwanda, mass murders, and from South Africa. And I very much welcome our panelists. I must say that Dr. Alexandra Mihalcea from Romania unfortunately had to stay at home because of her mother's grave illness. But the text of her presentation will be read to you. And this will be the second presentation. But now I would like to ask Dr. Ivana Janu to make the first presentation. Floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dámy a pánové, především bych velice poděkovala za pozvání na tuto konferenci. Jsem přesvědčena, že téma, které se zde probírá, je nesmírně důležité a že jakákoliv diskuze a jakékoliv informace poskytnuté od nás tady panelistů, pokud budou publikovány, takže můžou přispět hodně k celkové zlepšení situace v této problematice. Úvodem bych si dovolila říct takový malý úvod. Společnost v morální krizi, jejíž původ tkví v totalitárním režimu nedávné minulosti, se nemůže uzdravit, pokud si nenastaví zrcadlo. Musí se především ptát, jaký vlastně vztah k této minulosti má. A proto to se v naší společnosti, a myslím v žádné postkomunistické zemi, nijak moc neudělalo. Mým úkolem je všimnout si mezinárodních tribunálů a z jejich činnosti dovodit určité závěry, jak soudy mohou přispět k zjednávání spravedlnosti. Historie mezinárodního trestního soudnictví není dlouhá. Téměř každý po malém zamyšlení uvede, že první v řadě je Mezinárodní vojenský tribunál, který působil v Norimberku po druhé světové válce a soudil nacistické zločiny. Již ne tak známý, aspoň v našem povědomí, tady je Tokijský tribunál, který je z roku 1946 a měl podobný úkol jenom na jiném kontinentě. V roce 1993 vznikl Mezinárodní trestní tribunál pro bývalou Jugoslávii a o rok později Mezinárodní trestní tribunál pro Rwandu. Oba tyto soudy jsou soudy ad hoc, to znamená, že jsou určeny jenom k tomu, aby odsoudili příslušné zločiny, které byly vykonány na těch příslušných teritoriích, na území bývalé Jugoslávie a Rwandy. Oba tyto tribunály byly založeny Radou bezpečnosti a tento fakt, že byly založeny Radou bezpečnosti, rezolucí Rady bezpečnosti, vlastně posloužil k tomu, aby někteří, například pan Miloševič nebo pan Karadžič, ale i další, spochybňovali jejich legitimitu. K tomu bych chtěla jenom velice stručně říct. Katastrofální humanitární situace, která byla v této době v roce 92 na území bývalé Jugoslávie, prostě nesnesla odkladu. A normální cesta, to, co je argumentováno, že teda exekutivní orgán valného shromáždění nemá tuto pravomoc založit soud, vlastně je tímto argumentem do určité míry negován, poněvadž cesta přes valné shromáždění přes diplomatickou konferenci trvá 10 let, jak to víme ze soudu, který vznikl následně, a to je Mezinárodní trestní soud, který sídlí také v Hágu. Kromě toho valné shromáždění volí soudce obou těchto tribunálů, takže do toho říká své od samého začátku, a kromě toho valné shromáždění schvaluje rozpočet těmto soudům, a ten rozpočet není malý. Mezinárodní justice je velice drahá. Jak už jsem řekla, první v řadě je Norimberský tribunál. Já bych o tomto soudu chtěla pohovořit, poněvadž mám málo času, tak bych mu chtěla věnovat největší část svého expoze, a pak už ty další soudy s ním budu víceméně srovnávat. Já si myslím, že na to, že vznikl v roce 1945 jako první soud, takže že to byla instituce prostě nesmírně dokonalá, bych řekla. Svojí strukturou, svým statutem, s ochranou základních práv obžalovaných, obviněných. Víte, že v té době i vlastně tak moudrý člověk, jako byl Churchill, říkal, že žádný soud, teď my přeci víme, kdo oni jsou, a že by se to mohlo bývalo udělat rychlou cestou u zdi. Neudělalo. Byl zřízen soud a soud soudil a bylo to správné. A myslím si, že i dodneška slouží jako model všem ostatním soudům, nejen svojí strukturou, ale vlastně i svojí judikaturou tím, co rozhodl. Takže teď se zastavím nad některými. Tak všichni asi víme, že Norimberský tribunál byl tribunálem 4 vítězných mocností, Spojené státy, Anglie, Francie a Sovětský svaz. Byl tam i Sovětský svaz, který soudil, a ve stejné době na jeho území byly páchány stejné, někdy i horší zločiny. To musíme v tomhletom kontextu, na tomto fóru mít také, být si toho vědomi. Uzavřeli teda dohodu 4 mocností, kterou se ten tribunál založil. Rovněž si určili, že ty nejdůležitější, nejstrašnější zločiny a zločince odsoudí společně. A dali si v tom statutu na to dobu 1 roku. Ten soud skutečně soudil od 45. roku do 46. roku. A kromě toho tento soud ve svém statutu říkal, další státní a okupační soudy můžou soudit taky. Takže Britové měli své soudy a soudili v Holandsku, v různých zemích, kde prostě došlo předtím k páchání těch zločinů. Byl to soud, který... Každý člen z těch 4 tam měl 1 člena. Neříkalo se jim v tom statutu soudci, myslím si, že většinou to byly právnicky vzdělané osoby, ale myslím si, že nemuseli taky být. Nevím to přesně, ale myslím, že Rusko tam mělo tehdejšího velitele, který soudcem nebyl. Říká se jim, že měli každý 1 člena a každý jmenoval 1 zástupce. I to už vlastně v té době... A oni kladli důraz na rychlost těch procesů, bylo velice prozíravé, poněvadž jakmile soudce vypadne, tak prostě trestní řízení musí začít znova. Tady všichni ty 4 další jejich zástupci byli na všech těch jednáních, na všech těch řízeních, a jakmile soudce z nějakých důvodů nemohl, nastoupil tam ten zástupce. Tuto instituci například teda ten soud pro bývalou Jugoslávii zřídil mnohem později, takže vlastně když zemřel předsedající soudce Mayt z Velké Británie v Miloševičově případu, tak se proces musel zastavit na dlouhou dobu a nastoupil tam za něj jiný soudce, ale všecko prostě si musel nastudovat. Naštěstí tyto soudy, teď už dnešní mezinárodní soudy pracují pod kamerou, všecko je pod kamerou, a vlastně slovo od slova jsou transkripty, které zaznamenávají, co se u toho soudu. Takže ten nový soudce se na to dívá na obrazovce, a kromě toho má i... Takže ta substituce je tam možná. Ale tady ta moudrá substituce od začátku byla velice dobrá. Tento tribunál soudil zločiny proti míru, válečné zločiny a zločiny proti lidskosti. Nebyla tam genocida. Pač genocida vlastně vznikla až o dva roky později, v roce 1948, byla definována v příslušné mezinárodní úmluvě. Vyjmenuju zhruba, které trestné činy proti lidskosti už tehdy teda byly expresí sverbis v tom statutu vyjmenovány a v podstatě ty další soudy je nijak nerozšiřovaly. On je to sám rozšířený právní koncept. Jednalo se tedy o vraždu, vyhlazování, zotročování, deportace a další nelidské činy. To je ta otevřenost, ta deklaratornost, že se tam můžou přidat další zločiny. Musí být spáchání proti jakémukoliv civilnímu obyvatelstvu. A tady v tom statutu bylo před nebo během války, čili oni si všímali, že už k té trestné činnosti docházelo i před válkou a soudili bez ohledu na to, jaké právo bylo v té době v zemi, kde ten čin byl spáchán, ten trestný čin. To je taky zásada trestního práva, že v podstatě ten trestný čin musí být trestný v té zemi. Například v Německu už před válkou byl jiný zákon pro židovské obyvatelstvo a jiný zákon byl pro Němce. Takže ten soud to prostě tím statutem překlenul a přihlížel jenom k mezinárodnímu trestnímu právu. Co tam bylo dále důležité, a to přečtu z toho statutu. Je to článek 6. Vůdcové, organizátoři, podněcovatelé a spoluviníci, kteří měli účast na formulaci nebo provádění společného plánu nebo spiknutí ke spáchání některého ze zvýše zmíněných zločinů, budou odpovědni za všechny činy všech osob při provádění takového plánu. Někdo nahoře vymyslí plán a teď ten plán je prováděn dolů a dole je teda potom, jsou ty vraždy a je tam teda to kriminální prostředí, brutální, který je vidět. Ale už ten, kdo ten plán vymyslel, je trestnej a někdy jeho vina je daleko větší než vina těch, kteří to vykonávají dole. Dojdu k tomu v jednom dalším případu. Tento koncept už se nedostal do statutu trestního tribunálu pro bývalou Jugoslávii, ale nicméně soud dovodil ten institut toho společného plánu, kterýmu se po začátku říkalo common plan, common design, common criminal design. V konečných žalobách to potom mělo název Joint Criminal Enterprise a byl to vlastně společný kriminální podnik, čili rozjetá ta mašinerie od zhora až dolů. Ten jugoslávský tribunál šel do rozsudku tohoto soudu, byly to zejména anglické rozsudky, a tento institut prostě dovodil z ustanovení, které pojednává osobní odpovědnosti, individuální odpovědnosti, a dovodil ho vlastně na základě obyčejového práva, na kterým je jugoslávský soud staví. Pač vznikl v roce 1993 a soudí zločiny od roku 1991. Trestní tribunál nesmí mít žádný trestní soud zpětnou působnost. To je retroaktivita, která je zakázaná. Ale tím, že se začal opírat o humanitární právo obyčejového charakteru, to znamená to, co bylo ještě před nepsaným právem, tak vlastně toto právo, tyto trestné činy činilo trestnými již vlastně před tím rokem 91. Takže mohly být souzeny od 93. dále. Teď se dostanu, jak tento statut v článku 8 pojednával o oficiálním postavení obžalovaných a řekl, že postavení v moci jako hlav státu nebo členu vlád není bráno jako skutečnost, která by zprošťovala odpovědnosti, ani to není skutečnost, která zmírnuje trest. To je článek 7. V článku 8 je další důležitá věc, kterou toto přebírají ostatní tribunály, tuto zásadu. Skutečnost, že obžalovaný jednal na rozkaz své vlády nebo představeného, ho nezbavuje individuální odpovědnosti, maximálně by mohla být pokládána za polehčující okolnost, když je vyměřován trest. Ale viny to nikoho nezbavuje. Převzali další tribunály. A teď jde důležitá zásada, kterou už měl jenom Norimberský tribunál. To je článek 9. Při hlavním líčení s kterýmkoliv jednotlivým členem některé skupiny nebo organizace mohl Norimberský tribunál prohlásit, že skupina nebo organizace, které byl souzený členem, je organizací zločinnou. Pokud byla organizace či skupina, například SS, v souvislosti s tím individuálním případem a hrůzami, které vycházely při tom dokazování, prohlášena za zločinou, tak už ty ostatní soudy, které soudili jinde, toto brali za daný fakt, rozsouzenou věc, už to nemohl nikdo spochybňovat a už se nikdo nezdržoval s tím, že by to dokazoval znovu. Dalším pozoruhodným principem je, že spravedlivý proces a práva odsouzených měly vysokou úroveň a já bych to hodnotila tak, že splňují požadavky spravedlivého procesu i podle našich dnešních kritérií. Dotyčný obžalovaný se Bůh mohl hájit sám nebo prostřednictvím svého odpůrce, předvolával svědky obžaloby, mohl vyslýchat, mohl dělat jeho advokát křížový výslech, bylo tam prezumpce neviny platila, byly tam všechny tato kritéria, která jsou i v ostatních statutech. Rozsudek tohoto soudu nebo rozhodování tohoto soudu bylo prakticky jednoinstanční. To znamená, že soud rozhodl rozsudkem a už nikdo další rozhodovat nemohl. Další soud. Nebyla tam druhá instance. Nicméně kontrolní rada pro Německo měla možnost nikoliv změnit vinu, ale mohla jít do trestu a mohla zmírnit trest. Nemohla ho zpřísnit. Čili soud rozhodl definitivně o vině, ale trest, pokud ho nezhoršovala kontrolní rada, mohl být zmírněn. Co tam bylo dále důležité ve statutu Norimberského procesu, bylo, že jako trest bylo možno, jaký trest ukládal? Ukládal trest smrti anebo jiný spravedlivý trest. Později se dostanu k tomu, jak v tom jednom roce, jaké tresty byly uloženy. Čili mohl uložit trest smrti. Současné soudy trest smrti uložit nemůžou. Za kterýkoliv, jakkoliv závažný trestný čin může být maximálně uloženo do životí. Vedle trestu mohl tribunál zbavit odsouzeného, cituju doslova ze statutu, veškerého nakradeného majetku a nařídit jeho odevzdání ty kontrolní radě pro Německo. To, že vítězné mocnosti rozhodly vykonat společně, co mohla každá z nich vykonat jednotlivě na okupovaném území Německa, bylo v tvořícím se mezinárodním společenství poválečném přijato s respektem a byly tak položeny základy mezinárodního trestního soudnictví. Z těchto základů, jak už jsem v průběhu svého výkladu zmínila, z těchto základů čerpají všechny později ustavené mezinárodní trestní tribunály. Význam Norimberského tribunálu byl ještě posílen 11. prosince roku 1946, kdy valné shromáždění OSN jednomyslně přijalo rezoluci, kterou uznalo a potvrdilo právní principy mezinárodního práva, podle kterých soud postupoval, obsažené v jeho statutu a rozhodnutích. Dalo by se říci, že to byl v skutku tento krok k který formálně učinil ze soudu čtyř mocností soud mezinárodní, tak, jak byl ostatně širokou mezinárodní veřejností vnímán od svého založení. V průběhu zhruba jednoho roku stanulo před tímto soudem 24 bývalých nacistických pohlavárů, obžalovaných z těch trestných činů proti míru válečných, trestných činů proti lidskosti, které byly v průběhu těch 10 let té diktatury spáchány. Všichni obžalovaní, všichni popírali svoji vinu. Čili na začátku procesu prohlásili nevinné, not guilty. Další soudy, ty dva, o kterých jsem mluvila, tribunál pro Jugoslávii a pro Rwandu, které navazují na tento soud, jak jsem říkala, porovnáme-li jejich výkonnost, tak Norimberský tribunál za pouhý rok odsoudil 24 obžalovaných, z toho uložil 11 trestů smrti, 3 doživotí, 3 zprostil obžaloby a ostatní dostali od 10 do 20 let. Podíváme-li se na statistiku trestního tribunálu pro bývalou Jugoslávii, kde jsem působila po dobu 3 let, tak za 18-leté existence bylo obžalováno, vypracováno 161 obžalob a pravomocně bylo odsouzeno k červenci minulého roku 120 osob, tak teď jich je tak 125 možná. Jak je zřejmé, tak cenu za výkon si odnáší Norimberský tribunál. Jeden rok, 24 případů. Už jsem říkala, ty důvody byl jednoinstanční a mohl i soudit v nepřítomnosti, když byl dotyčný na útěku třeba. Což ty další tribunály už nemůžou. Čili se čeká, až se pan Karadžič objeví, až se objeví pan Mladič a další. Co vidím při tom soudit v nepřítomnosti není koncept zakázaný, jo? Je praktikován například v Itálii, ve Francii, v Rakousku, ve Švýcarsku i v naší zemi. Je pravda, že když se dotyční potom objeví, tak prostě ten proces na jeho žádost může být obnoven, ale co je důležité, svědci byli slyšeni a výpovědi jsou zaznamenány. Což je velmi důležité pro dokazování viny. Teď se dostávám k tomu soudu pro Jugoslávii, bývalou Jugoslávii, ve kterém jsem působila. Už jsem říkala, že byl založen jako ad hoc soud, čili skončí, jakmile odsoudíte ty zločiny z teritoria bývalé Jugoslávie, že byl založen Radou bezpečnosti, od kdy soudil, že to bylo vlastně 2 roky před svým založením a proč to nebyla retroaktivita. Jeho jurisdikce je souběžná s jurisdikcí národní, nicméně je prolomena i ta zásada ne bis in idem, dvakrát nelze v stejné věci, a je prolomena v případě, kdy dotyčný byl odsouzen soudem v bývalé Jugoslávii, nicméně se z toho rozsudku zjistí, že ten rozsudek jenom zastřešoval pro formu, aby prostě tady bylo rozhodnutí. Takže v tomhle případě je prolomena ta zásada a jugoslávský tribunál může takového člověka soudit znovu. Tento tribunál soudí válečné zločiny, genocídu, zločiny proti lidskosti. Zastavila bych se u individuální trestní odpovědnosti. Ta se vztahuje na osoby, které plánovali, podněcovali, nařizovali, páchali nebo jinak pomáhali v plánování, přípravě nebo páchání zločinu podle statutu, čili těch 3 typů skupin zločinů. Tito budou individuálně odpovědní. V druhém odstavci toho článku 7 je zase, že hlavy státu nemají žádná privilegia, budou souzeny Stejným způsobem žádné polehčující okolnosti, že vykonávali za stát svoji pravomoc, čili že to nebylo jejich vlastní osobní odpovědnost. Odpovědnost nadřízeného je dána, pokud za trestné činy, který páchá jeho podřízený, za situace, kdy nadřízený věděl nebo mohl vědět, že se ten podřízený chystá spáchat nebo už spáchal ty trestné činy a neučinil nic, aby tomu zabránil a v případě, že už byly spáchány, aby ho potrestal, tak v tom případě nese odpovědnost za trestné činy podřízeného. Čili vidíte, že ta odpovědnost, jak v tom prvním článku, za přípravu, podněcování, plánování, ten tribunál v podstatě tam může dát vysokou sazbu za tyto trestné činy ve srovnání s těmi trestnými činy, které byly potom už teda v terénu opravdu ty exekuce. Tak toto všecko tam hraje roli, jak už jsem říkala, tak tam spadá i ten zločinný, společný zločinný podnik, ta myšlenka, ty skupiny, toho kolektivního páchání těch trestných činů. Vždycky se posuzuje individuální odpovědnost, to je základ, to je princip trestního soudnictví. Ten jugoslávský senát pracuje v prvoinstanční úrovni a má odvolací komoru. V té první instanci pracují tři senáty, v té druhé instanci, složené ze tří soudců, ta druhá instance je potom složena z pětičleného senátu odvolacího, který je složen ze soudců jednak z Rwandy a jednak z toho jugoslávského, který se scházejí a soudějí v té druhé instanci všechny ty odvolání z obou soudů. Ty dva soudy jsou vlastně takový dvojčata svojí organizační strukturou i vlastně tím, co soudí. Takže toto je umožněno, aby se to zastřešení v ty odvolací instanci vlastně tímhletím způsobem. Takže posledním byl ten mezinárodní...
Excuse me, maybe we can leave some problems for the debate also. Then you can introduce them, but we are very much pressed by the time.
Tak já bych, ještě mi dejte, may I have another 5 minutes? Takže po tom všem, co jsem tady teda nemohla říct, všimala jsem si Komise pravdy a usmíření, tak jak byla podána soudu, všimala jsem si toho prohlášení viny prezidentky Biljany Plavčič, všimala jsem si ještě dalšího případu, kterým jsem chtěla dokumentovat, kdy prostý vojín střílel v Srebrenici, celý den zastřelil od 70 do 100 lidí a byl k tomu donucen. Chtěla jsem si všimnout tohoto, že ani to přímé donucení, že mu řekli, když nebudeš střílet, postav se do řady a budeš zastřelen, že nezbavuje individuální odpovědnosti. Prostě není možný, i když vám někdo drží pistoli u hlavy a máte zastřelit nevinného, spoutaného člověka, tak se nevykoupíte tím, že jste v ohrožení. Může to být bráno v úvahu jako polehčující okolnost, to znamená při výměře trestu. On taky za tento trestný čin, pač bylo prokázáno, tak dostal celkem 5 let. A teď úplně závěrem, ten výstup vlastně z toho, co jsem tu nemohla doříct, pro to téma, který tady máme. Moje prezentace vyústuje v závěr, jak zacházet s komunistickými zločiny v bývalých komunistických státech. Pak je následující. Válka v bývalé Jugoslávii trvala 5 let, 200 tisíc obětí. Druhá světová válka je označovaná jako nejmonstróznější konflikt v historii lidstva. 60 milionů obětí. Nacismus byl odsouzen Norimberským tribunálem, a jeho nositelé byli potrestáni. Nacistické zločiny jsou nepromlčitelné, aby se zdůraznila jejich ďábelský charakter. Komunistická ideologie, v jejímž důsledku byly napáchány zločiny srovnatelné s nacistickými, mezinárodním společenstvím odsouzena nebyla. Aspoň dosud. Bilance je děsivá. Podle Černé knihy Komunismu, první díl, 100 milionů obětí. Což opravdu každý z nás a celé mezinárodní společenství neví, že v zemích, jako je bývalý Sovětský svaz, Čína, Vietnam, Kambodža, východní Evropa a další, probíhal po celá desetiletí vnitřní destruktivní konflikt, kdy vládnoucí fanatické komunistické strany a jejich aparát doslova masakrovali civilní obyvatelstvo a uváděli celé národní, etnické, náboženské a třídní skupiny do genocidních podmínek. Na nastolení spravedlnosti není nikdy pozdě, ale plynutí času působí kontraproduktivně proti jejímu zjednávání. Oběti umírají a stárnou a přesnost jejich paměti bledne a oslabuje přesvědčivost jejich svědectví. Ke spravedlivosti samozřejmě spravedlnosti mohou přispět soudy mezinárodní, národní přiznání viny, komise pravdy jako jiná platforma k přiznání viny. Je škoda, že zákon o protiprávnosti komunistického režimu a odporu proti němu nebyl využit efektivněji. Nejen pokud jde o běh promlčecích lhůt, ale zejména k tomu, aby svým burcujícím obsahem podnítil politickou vůli k určení dostatečně kvalifikovaných skupin státních zástupců nebo skupiny a soudců k urychlenému zjednání nápravy a spravedlnosti. K otázce odpuštění a usmíření uvádím, že jen oběti mají právo odpouštět křivdy, na nich spáchané. Jen oběti mají právo vést tlustou čáru za minulostí, a to vždy jen a jen za bezprávím na nich spáchaném. Nikdo jiný toto právo nemá. A pokud si ho někdo přisvojí, účty postižených jsou nadále otevřené a nevyrovnané. Budu parafrázovat prohlášení prezidentky Biljany Plavčič, která přiznala v závěrečné řeči svoji odpovědnost před odsouzením v Hágu. Uvedla, každý, kdo úmyslně zmařil nevinné životy jiných, má pouze jeden svůj život, aby za svoje jednání mohl zaplatit. To říkám já na to, co já uzavírám, na to, co ona řekla. Ona řekla něco podobného. Čili každý má ten jeden jediný život. A i kdyby dal svůj život k dispozici, nemůže odčinit smrt 10 000, 100 000 a milionu. Proto mu nezbývá nic jiného, a to ona řekla, než požádat pokorně o odpuštění. Pokud je mi známo, žádní jednotliví členové komunistických stran ani jejich organizace tak dosud neučinili. Teď už končím. Civilizovaná společnost, která, říkám správně, bere výkon spravedlnosti z rukou oběti a ruší zákon odvety oko za oko, zub za zub. Je povinna, když toto udělá, a je to správné, je povinna k výkonu spravedlnosti přistoupit odpovědně a proporcionálně. Slovy doktora Borejna z Jihoafrické republiky, který tam komisi usmíření vedl, jeho slovy, oběti musí být slyšeny, je to imperativ. Oběti komunismu podle mého soudu slyšeny nebyly. Děkuji vám za pozornost.
Thank you very much for this survey and sharing your impressive expertise and experience. I'm very sorry I had to shorten press upon you because we are pressed by the time. But what you told, that it's never too late to bring about justice for the victims, I think it should be our leading thought. Thank you. And now may we listen to the written presentation by Madame Alexandra Mihalcea from Romania, who collaborated with International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Please.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Joel Tsilalye. I am the assistant of Bishop Laszlo Tökés. I am working in the European Parliament, and I am also a member of the Timișoara Society, whose member is our distinguished colleague Alexandra Mihalcea. And let me say, before I start to present his text, that in Romania, in next March, we will have the 20th anniversary of the proclamation of Timișoara. Point 8 of this declaration was tried to avoid the participation of Securitate and high-ranking communist leaders in public life. Unfortunately, the political elite did not accept it to codify this, so we still have high-ranking Securitate agents and communist leaders in the Romanian political life. I already shortened the speech. I hope you will enjoy it. The initial request was to present her experience regarding the massacre in Rwanda between Tutsis and Hutus from 1994, and trying to have some learnings regarding a possible European or international criminal tribunal regarding crimes of communism. So I start to present the text. When, between July and December 1999, I experienced international justice for the first time. Being close to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, little did I imagine that 10 years after I would officially link this close encounter to one of the most dramatic and painful efforts of my own people in the course of its history, the fight against communism. I admit that it often crossed my mind while Arusha, the Tanzanian headquarters of the tribunal, in just a theoretical way, to make parallels between the Rwandan genocide and the Romanian tragedy for almost half a century. But now I realize that we can do much more than drawing philosophical parallels. We are going to put together our own knowledge and experience in order to learn whether humanity is willing and capable to bring to justice the crimes of communism. Is there sufficient political will to do it? Do we have sufficient legal instruments or others necessary to be created? We have at least two allies, international law, existent or to be developed, which is the instrument, and international justice, which is the force. I must say that reading the program of the present conference was extremely encouraging to me. The goals of this meeting are just what humanity needs. Now let us go back to the Rwandan experience. Rwanda is called also African Switzerland. There are two main ethnic groups, Tutsis, minority, and Hutus, majority. In 1994, things exploded. The plane with Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana, who was accompanied by the Burundi President and other officials, was gunned down shortly before landing on the Kigali airport. This was the start of mass killing of Tutsis and moderate Hutus by Hutu whom we should call fundamentalists. The total number of victims is still officially unknown, around 1 million people, Tutsis were massacred during individual or mass killings between April and June 1994. I was appointed assistant counsel in the team of Maître François Roux from the Bureau de Montpellier, lead counsel in the case. Lead counsel in the case. To defend the former mayor of the Mabanza commune, Ignace Baghelichema. My activity lasted 6 months and I worked in Arusha, in Paris and in Montpellier. At the end of this trial, Ignace Baghelichema was acquitted. How does the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda function? First, prosecution. The prosecutor's office of the ICTR, based in Kigali, performs the actual investigation. It seeks evidence, it gathers witness depositions, it travels to the fields, etc. There was a tremendous advantage of the ICTR as well as of the Criminal Tribunal for ex-Yugoslavia. They were dealing with very recent facts. The actors of the deaths were still alive and capable to stand before justice. So what happened in our case with the communist trial? What evidence do we still have? Where are the actors now? Are they still alive? Are they occupying important positions in state and government hierarchy? Are they heads of important political parties? Whom should we question? Where are the victims, etc.? Yes, there are remarkable authors like Stéphane Courtois or Thierry Volton who dedicated their lives in studying the crimes of communism. There are other scholars, high prestigious historians like our fellow countryman, Marius Oprah, who not only studied facts but tried to act. Some of them are authors of drafts of laws which have never been adopted. There are civil activists such as Timișoara Society who endeavor to impose a law of lustration in Romania. How could we keep on fighting to create a court for the crimes of communism when smaller and less radical attempts failed discouragingly? I will not try to draw any conclusion. Coming back to my initial fear, I feel myself complaining. Turning again to the prosecution of the crimes of communism, it should deal with at least 50 years of terror and non-human acts. Compared to the Rwandan genocide, where the genocide lasted 3 months, according to the official internationally accepted and prosecuted version, and victims about 1 million people, the communist genocide lasted almost a century and made 100 times more victims, according to Stéphane Courtois, documented in a black book of communism where 100 million victims are presented. Another essential starting point should be, as far as the prosecution is concerned, the set of values defended by the tribunal, which should be established a priori by the international community as an expression of their will to achieve justice in matter. I believe there must first be an official and general acknowledgement, an admission of the very existence of crimes and of their possible inclusion into the definition of genocide and that of crime against humanity. The acknowledgement should conclude that these regimes were totally and essentially illegal. We also must deny communism the right to claim a legitimate status, and moreover, we should proclaim its illegality and determination to prosecute and to condemn it legally. For the achievement of the goal of making justice possible, we must admit there were crimes, for the elementary reason that there are victims. Trials. First of all, the legal basis for the trials in the tribunal's bylaws, le statut de tribunal, which in fact represents the substantial applicable law. It is interesting to observe that regarding the Geneva Convention, those responsible for genocide were not only the actual perpetrators, but also the ones from whom the orders came. I believe that here there is a large field of debate for in Romania, for example. Many years after the 1989 revolution, there were far too many discussions about around the problem of the blind execution of the military order. Coming back to our own discussion, the court to be should have such substantial law to be based on. Either a regulation similar to the ICTRs, or it should be a broad and deep declaration, both juridical and political, of the world states, made individually or institutionally. If such a declaration could have the form of an international treaty, then it would definitely be bounding for the signing parties. Based on the model of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and or on that of the European Convention of Human Rights. The procedure before such a court is also essential for its well functioning. It became a custom that international ad hoc courts work in languages, the English and French. Legal proceedings using common law and codified law. Many other questions should be asked. How should its competence be? Ratione loci, limited or general in space. Ratione tempori, limited or unlimited in time. Ratione materiae, dealing with all or only some categories of crimes. What should be the object of such tribunal, individuals or and institutions? There should be permanent political instruments to support and to assist such a court, otherwise it could not resist neither in time nor in its decisions. I think we are not wrong in considering that the trial of communism regimes began with the admittance of ex-communist European countries in the Council of Europe and their submission to the European Convention of Human Rights, as well as to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights. Thus, it was possible even since 1993 for Romania to reach restitutio in integrum, in some cases, in civil matters, when the court in Strasbourg pronounced decisions to restore property previously nationalized, confiscated by the communist regimes, but there was also a condemnation of states for unjust prosecution or sentencing. However, through some very important decisions, the court extended the effects of its decisions also to remotely anterior periods, such as the decisions when the court stated that it has been continuous violation of the right to property since the act of communist nationalization in the early 50s till the present days, see judgment of 2005 in the case of Strain and others versus Romania. But in the case of the European Court of Human Rights, the jurisprudence which accomplished such an extension of competence is still poor and deals more with concrete and specific facts than with matters of principle. For example, one is still compelled to prove before the ECHR the abusive character of confiscation during communist regimes. I do not know if these parallels can be of use. Experience can be of use. God will can be of use. Determination can be of use. Conviction as well. And above all, responsibility, care, and active sympathy for the victims. Alexandra Răzvan Mihalcea, Timișoara.
So, I, Mr. Kalam, I cut around 40% of the text, so may I kindly ask the organizers and those who have access to the website to put it on the website. Thanks.
Absolutely. This was a very, very good text, and thank you for your eloquent presentation of this. We'll send our best wishes to Madame Mihalcea, to Timișoara, by our friends, Laszlo Türkes and you. And I think this was very important when she deliberated about the possible scope of a future tribunal and the need for a permanent institution to support its activities. But now we have the pleasure to welcome our friend from South Africa, Tsiki Sandi, who was member of the Amnesty Committee of the well-known South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was established in 1995. And we will be very, very fascinated to listen to your report, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm very much aware of the fact that time is against us. I will try and be very quick to deliver the talk, which is a prepared statement from me about the Truth Commission in South Africa and the political context in which this commission was established. Let me first thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me to be one of the speakers today and to share the experiences we all have from the different countries and regions where we come from. I think this is a very important conference in that it should pave the way for all the different nations of this region as to how they should deal with the so-called post-communist situation in their respective countries. And speaking for myself, I would like to say that as South Africans, we wish you very well in your attempts to achieve that. What I would describe as an extremely difficult and sensitive exercise. I do not know the history of this country and the history of the different countries in Eastern Europe, Central Eastern Europe, but I do know that at some point these countries were under communist regimes and there were lots of problems. Atrocities were committed, people suffered, and all that cannot be pushed under a carpet. To begin with, I was born in South Africa, I grew up there, and I received most of my education there. The only time I was out of the country was in 1993, 1994, when I went to study in England. I have a personal experience of how the apartheid system worked. I saw most of the madness of that system and how it came to an end in the early 90s. Up to 1994 when the first democratically elected government came into a place with Dr. Nelson Mandela becoming the first black president of the country. I do not intend to bore you with the historical effects, namely what brought that system to an end, and so on, but if I can summarize it, with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, it became increasingly difficult, if not extremely difficult, for the apartheid regime to continue using communism as an excuse to exclude the majority from power. As you will know, the theory of the white minority regime of the day was that black liberation movements were being instigated. They're being instigated by communists from Eastern Europe, the major culprit being Russia, and so on and so on. But there were also other factors that led to the collapse of that system. The country was ungovernable, and there was a lot of defiance, not only from the black majority, but from the white community as well. There was increasing contempt by whites of what was supposed to be a white government. White boys were refusing to go to the army. Some of them, they would be sent to jail. It became a very difficult situation for that regime to continue to hold on to. Otherwise, the alternative was a bath of unprecedented proportions, which could have created more problems for the government. Change in South Africa is sometimes described as a miracle, because many people used to think that apartheid would one day explode into flames, an open war between blacks and whites. However, this never happened. And in April 1994, as I've said, we had the first democratic elections with Mandela as the first black president. But of course, many people died before a change came in that country. But in the end, change was relatively peaceful. And South Africa is proud to be counted amongst the most progressive, non-racial democracies in the world today, with a Bill of Rights, which is judicially reviewable. Now, coming back to the theme of the day, is transitional justice. The United Nations, a report to the Secretary General on the rule of law and transitional justice in conflict and post-conflict societies, describes transitional justice as processes and mechanisms associated with a society's attempts to come to terms with a legacy of large-scale past abuses in order to ensure accountability, to serve justice, and to achieve reconciliation. But the question is, how does a nation which has undergone a long period of repression and human rights abuses reconcile and unify its peoples into one nation? How does such a nation create a new ethos and culture of human rights and ensure that what has happened in the past does not happen again? What is the role of the law enforcement agencies, such as the police and the courts, in such a process? What is the role of the media, for example? What is the role of the churches, faith groups, educational institutions, and so on? Shouldn't these institutions be helping the emerging society to rebuild itself by educating the present generation about the wrongs of the past in a positive way, and thereby ensure that the past is not repeated? These are some of the difficult questions we have had to deal with in South Africa. The following is what I would describe as fundamental truths on the matter. There can be no lasting reconciliation without the truth. The truth in its ugly form must be known before those who perpetrated human rights abuses can be forgiven. There is simply no shortcut to a lasting peace, stability, and prosperity for any nation that has experienced human rights abuses in the past. It does not matter what name you give to those who committed such atrocities. You can only have a united nation if both the perpetrator and the victim agree that what happened yesterday is wrong. It should not have happened in the first place. They should also agree that it will never happen again. The victims must be allowed to ventilate and tell their stories. Perpetrators must publicly confess that they have caused harm to many people in the past, to their fellow citizens. They must repent and show genuine remorse before they can be forgiven. But the idea that victims must simply forget and forgive is dangerous, because it trivializes the pain and the suffering of the victims. It can also lead to a false reconciliation, which is dangerous for the future. In the program, the question is raised how to deal with the communist crimes in former communist countries. Now, that is the question this panel is supposed to try and contend with. Now, my answer to that is, I do not know. I do not know. Not coming from this country, not coming from this region, I am not able to pontificate. I'm not in a position to come from South Africa and say, this is the way we've done in South Africa. It should be good for you. It has worked for us, and so on. Each situation, each country has to find solutions that will be suitable for its own dynamics. Its nation, in dealing with such matters, has to display prudence, sensitivity to the complexities, of its situation, its history, and a whole lot of other factors which make one situation different from another. It is not wise, I'm not saying this is what you intend to do, it is not wise to import solutions from the other countries and superimpose them on your own situation simply because they've worked for those other people. Of course, external experience is very relevant, because what has happened in other countries will always provide useful lessons for other nations which still have to undertake the same journey. I'm trying to say here that I am very much aware of the extremely difficult in nature of the exercise you appear to be intending to embark upon, namely to revisit the human rights abuses that have occurred in the past. Perhaps in South Africa we were fortunate, because by the time our commission was established in 1995, there were already quite a number of similar commissions that had been formed in other countries such as Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and so on. We were able to learn very useful lessons from those countries. As Immanuel Kant says, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. Reconciliation is a process, and it is not an event. The TLC was born. The TLC, that is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa. The TLC was born out of the realization that what had happened during the apartheid era could not be swept under the carpet. There was not going to be any general amnesty. The past had to be confronted head on to try and heal the wounds of those who had suffered in many different ways. In our situation, there was no victor and the vanquished. So the Nuremberg type of trials was out of the question. In any case, experience had already shown that political trials, which we've had up to now, were far too expensive for the new government, which is facing a huge backlog on social services such as public health, education, housing, job creation, etc. Now, the act that created the commission was called Promotion of National Unity and Reconciliation Act. It was not titled the Promotion of Justice Act. The focus was more on nation building and reconciliation. I have said earlier that I have a personal knowledge, I have a personal encounter and experience of the madness and the atrocities of the apartheid system. When we were in detention for months and months in the 1980s without a trial, as political detainees, we used to talk amongst ourselves how we would revenge, how we would revenge. But the situation now is that we had to deal with the reality of the situation. I've said earlier that when one is dealing with this question, one has to be sensitive, he has to be prudent, and I would also add that one should not be over ambitious, should not be vengeful, you should not be vindictive. And you should look for institutions that will work. You have to do something that will work for the good of the country and for the for future generations. It is not a matter of how bitter I am, how bitter I am about what happened to me. What is important is that both the victim and the perpetrator are fellow citizens. But of course, as I've said earlier, a perpetrator has to collaborate and tell the truth if he wants to be forgiven. Then in my paper, I go on to deal with the legal challenges that have failed in the courts, including the Constitutional Court, to have the legislation declared unconstitutional. I will not read that. The preamble to the first constitution, which we had in 1994, which I will refer to as the interim constitution, the post-amble, rather, read as follows. It read as follows. It said, this constitution is a historic bridge between the past of a deeply divided society, characterized by strife, conflict, untold suffering and injustice, and a future founded on the recognition of human rights, democracy, and peaceful coexistence, and development opportunities for all South Africans, irrespective of color, race, class, belief, or 6. This statement in the Constitution went on to say the following, that the aim was to secure the foundation for the people of South Africa to transcend the divisions and strife of the past, which generated gross violations of human rights, the transgression of humanitarian principles in violent conflicts, and a legacy of hatred, fear, guilt, and revenge. Introducing amnesty, then it said the following, introducing amnesty says, that these can now be addressed on the basis that there is now a need for understanding, but not for revenge, a need for reparation, but not for retaliation, a need for ubuntu, but not for victimization. Then it concluded, in order to advance such reconciliation and reconstruction, amnesty shall be granted in respect of acts, omissions, and offenses associated with political objectives and committed in the course of the conflicts of the past. Now, the TRC, amongst its objectives, was to address the question of amnesty for those who qualified, those who met the requirements that were set out in the legislation, namely, to show that the act, I'm going to summarize this, I'm not going to read all this legal language, to show that the act committed was a politically motivated offense. Number two, to make a full disclosure. In other words, to tell the truth. I sat in that committee from the beginning to the end of the TRC process, and I listened to many applicants for amnesty as well as the victims giving evidence. Some of them would refuse amnesty, others we would grant, depending on the circumstances. I'm sure you will be interested to know how many people were granted amnesty at the end of the day by the Truth Commission. We received thousands. We received over 7,000 applications. We received over 7,000 applications, and only 1,167 of those applications were granted. 5,143 were refused. Now, the reasons for refusal of such applications ranged from lack of political objective and failure to make a full disclosure. In other cases, applicants would be denied amnesty because they would still maintain that they are not guilty of the offences, but still be asking for amnesty. Now, that's a contradiction in terms. If you're seeking amnesty, you have to make an unequivocal admission of guilt and say, I committed this offence, but these were the circumstances under which I was acting. That was the only, and you tell the truth. That was the only way to qualify for amnesty. Now, regarding the constitution of the TRC and its mandate, the TRC had 17 commissioners who were all appointed by the state president in consultation with the cabinet. And all these people had to go through a public process of interviews. They were interviewed openly. The interviews would be on national television, and it was a requirement that these people had to be fit and proper to be commissioners to do such a sensitive job. And these people had to have a low political profile. The act said they must not have a high political profile, and they must be known to be able to be impartial. Then the TRC had three committees. It had the Human Rights Violations Committee, it had the Amnesty Committee, it also had the Reparations Committee. In order to fulfill its task, the Commission had an investigation unit. It had statement takers who I would describe as sort of field workers who would go and interview people in the community. They would take statements, sworn statements from those victims, and the allegations from the victims would be investigated by the investigation unit. Then there was the research unit, which comprised academics, people who had established themselves in the field of research. Then there would be public hearings held by the Human Rights Violations Committee. And once a hearing has been held by the Human Rights Violations Committee, it will be decided whether that person can be declared a victim or not a victim in terms of the act. Once the finding has been made by the Human Rights Violations Committee that the person is a victim as defined in the Act, then such a person will be referred to the Reparations Committee so that the Reparations Committee can make appropriate recommendations as to what sort of reparations should be effected in that particular situation. The Commission received about 22,000 statements, and 22,000 statements from victims, the majority of whom were blacks, were Africans. I set out the figures in my paper. I will not read them. But these figures reflect the history of the country, because apartheid was essentially directed at the black black component of our population, and resistance came mainly from the black communities. Of course, there was resistance from the other groups as well. The report, which was presented by the Commission, listed the names of the victims as well as the names of perpetrators. But not all victims appeared before the Commission. What the Commission would do would select a number of cases for purposes of holding a public hearing. Now, these cases, we describe them as window cases that can give a picture of what has been happening generally. And I must say, this was a very difficult job to do. The hearings were widely publicized on television, in the print media, including simultaneous transmissions on radio in all languages. One cannot talk about the South African Truth Commission without mentioning the legal, the perceptions it encountered from certain quarters. It was perceived to be a witch hunt game. Any attempt to look into the atrocities of the past will always be seen as a witch hunt game or persecution of some sort. But as time goes on, people begin to understand that the process is not really a witch hunt game, depending, of course, on how effective that process is to carry out its mandate. Now, although we all knew as South Africans, although we all knew as South Africans that apartheid was a repressive system which would only be maintained through brute, by means of brute and force, people were very shocked to learn for the first time how that system, how the repression of that system was implemented. And I think this contributed to change the attitudes and perceptions many people had about the TLC, thinking that it was a witch hunt game. I think the remainder of my paper, I will only be able to read with some of the issues that I've dealt with in my paper when I address questions from you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sunday, for coming and sharing your experience. And I think it is probably the closest to the Central and East European countries. But what was very interesting, you mentioned the connection between crumbling of the regime in South Africa and the disintegration of communism at the beginning of 1990s. So we do have links and also opportunity to exchange experience. And I think what is very important, you're told that there will be no lasting reconciliation before exposing the truth. And truth should be admitted by both sides. And also, reconciliation is a process, not an event. And it should strengthen unity, not sponsor revenge. I think this is a very, very valuable presentation, and we hope to receive your full text and publish it in the conference documentation. And then I think we need to close by 2 o'clock. I have not got signals from the organizers, but we should have been ended at 1 o'clock. Still, we have a very important presentation by Dr. Boris Burkhardt, who is expert on international criminal law, and I would like to offer the floor to you. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, let me briefly and very informally thank you for having me here. As you have just heard, you see me on this panel as an expert scholar of international criminal law, which is also part of the problem I have to face now, because while Mr. Sandy and Honorable Judge Yanu could present their thoughts saturated by rich personal and professional experience, I can only offer you some academic thoughts on the issue, which I hope, however, will find your interest, although we all long for lunch. Now, let me start with a picture. This is a picture of the body of Peter Fechter. Fechter, an 18-year-old bricklayer, attempted to flee from East Berlin to West Berlin together with his friend Helmut Kuhlbeig on August 17th of 1962. They jumped into the so-called death strip, ran across it, and started to climb over the 2-meter wall topped with barbed wire. While Kuhlbeig succeeded in crossing the wall, Fechter was shot in the pelvis by GDR border guards. He fell back into the death strip on the eastern side, where he remained screaming for help for about an hour until he faded into agony and died. Now, for the GDR's communist regime of Walter Ulbricht, the death of Peter Fechter, or rather the concrete circumstances of his death, was a real disaster. Because as you can see, pictures were taken. And this picture particularly became one of part of the collective memory. Let me also briefly, mainly almost not as a part of my presentation, but share a small thought that maybe part of the frustration I have seen within many conference participants here by the ignorance of perhaps many people from Western Europe, maybe also explained that at least for me, there are not so many pictures of the sufferances and of the mass crimes of communist regimes. I mean, everybody is thinking, when thinking about fascist crimes and the crimes of the Nazi regime, about the bodies of Bergen-Belsen, or also the glasses and the shoes, and pictures, images may be lacking. And so especially on an educational level, you should try to find pictures if you maybe want, because I would say that the mere way, by the way that the shoe of Peter Fichte is lying at his feet, is has maybe a greater impact than figures. So Peter Fichte became one of the most prominent victims of the so-called GDR border regime. Between 1946 and 1989, at least 270 persons were killed on the inner German border by mines, self-firing machine guns, and in the vast majority, shot dead by border guards. As we have heard yesterday by Mr. Schäfgen, these killings were prosecuted afterwards by German tribunals. However, German tribunals applied German law only and did not assess whether these events qualified as crimes against humanity. In my contribution, I will shortly try to show that this was indeed the case. Now, what are crimes against humanity? Crimes against humanity, we have heard a lot about this notion, are mass crimes violating fundamental human rights of a civilian population. A recent definition can be found in Article 7 of the Statute of the International Criminal Court. The text of the provision is quite long, so I just give you an excerpt here. And I also want to concentrate on the structure of the crime. There we can easily discern that a crime against humanity consists of two basic elements. One is the single act that has to be committed. The single act can be murder, torture, rape, etc. And you find the alternatives enumerated in letters A to G of the provision. And the second is the context element. The single act has to be committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population. However, before we can assess whether the facts fall under this definition, we have to ask if crimes against humanity were binding international law at the time of the GDR border shootings, that is, between 1946 and 1986. So our legal assessment comprises three steps. Crimes against humanity as binding international law at the time, killings at the inner German border as pertinent single acts, and the context element, a widespread or systematic attack against the civilian population. Were crimes against humanity binding law at the time? From today's perspective, a strong case can be built that yes, indeed, crimes against humanity between 1946 and 1989 had already gained the status, the quality of international jus cogens. Our case would be built primarily upon Nuremberg and the Tokyo precedent that we have earlier heard of, and even more important, on a changing general idea of international law as such. And this general idea can be resumed briefly as that the basic values of the international community are peace and human rights, and state sovereignty ends where the basic values of the international community are violated. And if a state does not guarantee and secure the human rights of its inhabitants, its law lacks legitimacy. So, however, we should also not be oblivious to the fact, we should keep in mind that during the Cold War, things looked different. Nuremberg and Tokyo seemed more like a dead end of international law then. And it's no coincidence that, for example, if you look at the contributions made in the early 1990s on the subject that I'm talking about, so before the UN installed the Rwanda and Yugoslavia Tribunal, the vast majority of authors writing on my topic took it for granted that crimes against humanity had not become part of international customary law. But from today's perspective, fortunately, the standstill situation of Cold War era seems more that this standstill situation did not change the normative convictions spelled out in Nuremberg, in Tokyo, and above all in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And to argue otherwise, I would say, would confuse mere political practice with the practice of law. So, were the killings at the inner German border, could they be qualified as one of the pertinent single acts of the crime against humanity? Now, maybe at first glance this seems quite clear. At least 270 people were intentionally killed at the inner German border by firearms, mines, and self-firing machine guns. However, what we also have to assess is whether these killings were unlawful under international law. I argue, was also the case. These killings constitute violations of the right of life as a universally binding human right. Now, we've also yesterday heard that GDR law justified these killings, but this law was based on the premise that crossing the border illegally constituted a crime. However, from an international law perspective, the attempt to leave the GDR merely qualifies as the use of another human right, the right to leave a country. So while each state has a large scope of discretion in restricting this right, it is evident that a complete and durable deprivation of this freedom is not compatible with international law, with the principle that this is a freedom, a human right. And this was the exact situation for the vast majority of the GDR population. For decades, it was virtually impossible to leave the country in a legal way. Even more, once you tried to invoke your right to leave the country, you found yourself in a position where discriminatory measures were taken against you, like losing your job or your place to study. You were threatened and, under some circumstances, criminally prosecuted. So the regulations reducing the right to leave the country to nothing in the GDR were unlawful under international law. The GDR law declaring that illegally leaving the country was a crime was thus also unlawful under international law. And as a consequence, the violations of the right to life were thus also unlawful under international law. Now, the context elements. We have to assess whether these killings were committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack against civilian population. I think it's quite easy to show that this was the case. First, as part of an attack against a civilian population. There you find a definition that has been given in Article 7.2a of the ICC statute. It's not a very good definition. But what we can gather from this definition is that we need a course of conduct. That course of conduct, and here we have to amend the ICC statute to narrow it a little bit, the ICC statute's definition, has to aim on the violation of human rights of a civilian population. And pursuing that aim involves then the multiple commission of crimes mentioned as single acts. However, what we do not need and what may be the intuitive idea of crimes against humanity is this mass violence. So this has been spelled out on various occasions by the international tribunals. So such a course of conduct can be seen in the facts we are evaluating on the SED politics, on the politics of the Communist Party of the GDR, to prevent their population to leave the country. Simple as that. This political program aimed at the deprivation of the right to leave the country, so a human right, It involved the violation of further human rights by discriminatory measures, particularly criminal prosecution, and ultimately the intentional killing, thus a single act, murder, of persons trying to cross the border. This act was also systematic. It was orchestrated at the highest level of the state and comprised a multitude of legislative, administrative, and purely factual measures at all levels of the state. And this attack was also widespread. We not only have 270 persons that were killed at the border directly, we have thousands of persons, people prosecuted, discriminated, threatened, and intimidated. So I'm coming to the final part of my contribution, and I hope I'm in time. The first conclusion is the killings of East German citizens attempting to flee to West Germany qualify as murder as a crimes against humanity. I don't know the fact situations on other Eastern European countries that similar border regimes, but I suppose that the results may be transferable. The second conclusion concerns maybe some of the advantages of taking recourse to international criminal law in general when dealing with state crimes. I will be very brief here. One or two advantages that I will only mention are no statute limitations and universal jurisdiction. Three potential advantages that in my contribution I should have clarified a little are, one, international criminal law provides you with an alternative tool to deal with the nullum crimen sine lege that we have also talked about in the past days of the conference, the nullum crimen sine lege problem. The problem arises because under the rule of law in a Rechtsstaat, we are bound to the principles of principle of culpability and thus to the principle of non-retroactivity of criminal laws. So in principle, our rule of law obligates us to judge the behavior of people in our understanding criminal system by the law of that particular system. This is not a very comfortable and satisfying situation for a lawyer. International criminal law gives us solution to face this problem. Its very principle is, and I've stated this earlier, it's not the state law that ultimately counts. What matters is, in the end, is the international law. And state law is only legitimate as far as it is not contrary to the basic values of the international community, so peace and human rights. Regarding our nullum crimen sine lege problem, the particular appeal and grace of international criminal law is that it gives you at hand a legal order that was arguably already in effect at the time of the crimes that were committed, so no violation of nullum crimen sine lege, and moreover had prerogative to the law of the international criminal of the criminal system without being as metaphysical as natural or divine law. The second advantage that I want to stress out is that international criminal law provides you with the categories that fit better than ordinary national criminal law. This advantage has two aspects. First, what happened on the inner German border, the death of Peter Fechter, was not an isolated intentional killing. It formed part of a general pattern, and this is not reflected when using the legal categories we find in almost every national criminal code, so manslaughter, murder. However, being at this conference, a second advantage or second aspect of this advantage became also very clear to me. Crimes against humanity is the appropriate level also because it emphasizes that what is important for our legal assessment at least, and indeed for our normative evaluation, is the violation of human rights on a massive scale, regardless of the political context in which they occurred. So as a lawyer, at least, I can only advise strongly to abstain from using categories like communist crimes. Such a term may be correct from an historical point of view. I'm not so sure if it is epistemologically meaningful. It seems quite certain to me that from a political point of view, it is counterproductive. But what I'm positively sure is that the fact that these crimes were committed by communist regimes does not constitute any valuable reason for criminalizing or prosecuting them. Your legitimacy for criminal prosecution is based exclusively on their character as gross human rights violations. And it's very important for me to emphasize this. The last advantage is a prospective one. By taking recourse to international criminal law, you foster the very idea of human rights and international criminal law. You provide further case material on which can be relied in support of later cases. You thus facilitate the work for anybody who will like to invoke the rationale of international criminal law and human rights in the future, thereby spreading the logic and ultimately their effectiveness. Honestly speaking, this is the reason that I like the most. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burkhardt. I must say I was most positively impressed by your creative approach to these problems on the model of Berlin Wall. And I think it is a very practical contribution how we could deal with these crimes and how to assess them. So we hope to count upon your experience and your contribution in the near future. And now I would like to thank you all for your patience and interest. But I would allow three questions to be presented. One, two, three. That's all. Please start from here.
I have a question to Dr. Sandi. At the time, I was also interested in South Africa, questioned the battle against apartheid. I read some ANC papers. And the ANC papers are printed in East Germany, in communist Berlin. And one of these papers, I read an article about the visit of Mr. Nkomo. It was the colleague of Mr. Mugabe. He went to to Prague to see Mr. Husák, I think to get the weapons. And how was it at that time? He was there as a fighter. And why, against the regime of apartheid, I want to say, and why he didn't visit Mr. Havel? He was at that time in the prison. If you want to see the people who are suffering, you fighting for suffering under apartheid, why didn't he visit the man who was suffering under the communist regime? I think we have to take this in account in your Secret Consultation Committee, because to get things clear.
Thank you. We'll listen to all questions first. Please, next one. And the microphone.
Thank you. My name is Sandra Botha. I'm the South African ambassador here. I couldn't help but be struck by the irony, and perhaps it links to what was said at the back here, about the international support and local that the South African government, the apartheid regime, got because it was virulently anti-communist. And therefore, when Dr. Burkhardt was talking about what you would call crimes, it's important, I think, when you are thinking about one terminology, that you keep this in mind. And it's interesting that, of course, now we have the South African Communist Party, a very viable party in South Africa, of whom many members actually were lucky enough to get their education in communist Eastern Europe. But I want to just speak, if I may, it's not a question, but it's one comment just to add on to what my compatriot was saying about the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was not about justice. I think it's important, I think, that we think, that we remember that. It was about unity and reconciliation. And recently, the Parliament, the South African President in 2007, made a special dispensation in which the people who were not pardoned in the early years could apply again for pardon, and the decision would be made by Parliament. And fortunately, we have now seen that there's been a Constitutional Court decision that the victims have to be taken into consideration, that Parliament cannot pardon, but it's only after speaking to the victims, and that they are heard, that any pardon could be considered. Thank you.
And the last question, please.
Jan Schinagel. Po té, co tu zazněly tyto komentáře, logicky se nabízí tato otázka. Včera prohlásil litevský prezident bývalý, pan Vytautas Landsbergis, současný europoslanec, že v roce tuším 1990 došlo k děsivému masakru v televizní věži vrahy poslanými z Kremlu, které patřily přímo do kompetence Michaila Gorbačova, pozdějšího nositele Nobelovy ceny. Já se ptám, kdo podá trestní oznámení, pokud to má být já, na koho se mám obrátit a kam ho mám podat. Děkuji.
Would you like to react, all three of you, if possible?
Thank you, Chairperson. I must first thank my sister from South Africa, Sandra, our ambassador, for filling me in on some of the relevant facts in this matter. But before I answer the question that was raised by the gentleman at the back there, may I inquire as to what exactly he was asking? I could not. Can you ask the question in short form? I could not quite understand it. Your question is, why was who not arrested in South Africa?
Now, my point was that I was quite surprised at the time that all the publication for ANC were published in East Berlin. And I read an article in one of these papers that Nkomo went to Prague to see Mr. Husák for official, or not official, it couldn't be official. And as far as I can read it in the article, he wanted to deal something about weapons. And at the same time, Mr. Havel, a famous dissident, a well-known dissident, he was in jail. And why didn't he visit such a dissident while he was pretending to be also a dissident? Let me say it in that way.
Why did
Nkomo? And I think he forget to do that, and I think that's an aspect you have to take in account. Because I want to become ready with this problem. I can't become ready with this problem. I want to clear it off.
Okay. Your question is, why did Mr. Nkomo from Zimbabwe not visit Mr. Havel?
No, not me. He visited Mr. Husák. He was the communist president from the Republic of Czechoslovakia at that time.
Yeah, but
I think you have some knowledge of the European circumstances.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I can't explain it to you. I think it's not a forum to explain it to you.
But I think this is a rather complicated question, and Mr. Nkomo should be asked first about this. But let's go on. Would you like to comment make some conclusions about your presentations?
Já jsem nerozuměla dost dobře otázce pana Schinagla. Jestli jste myslel, abychom odpovídali tak, který mezinárodní soud ze stávajících by se tím měl zabývat, tak žádný k tomu nemá kompetenci. V kterýmže to bylo roce? No. Takže ty dva soudy, co existují, jsou ad hoc. Soudějí teda předem danou vymezenou materii, jedna Jugoslávie, jedna Rwandu. A pak je tady ten permanentní soud, který ovšem soudí až trestný činy, které se staly až od roku 2002, od července dopředu. Takže žádný mezinárodní soud se tímto zabývat nemůže, musí se to vyřídit v té zemi, kde se to stalo. Nemáte žádnou možnost. Možnost máte, ale patrně budete ztrácet jenom čas.
Děkuji.
So I would also say that it basically comes down to the national jurisdictions. The national jurisdictional power on an international level, you have certain principles that are accepted, as for example the territoriality principle. So where the massacres have taken place, these states have the jurisdiction, of course, to criminally prosecute them. And then you have also the principle that the state can prosecute that its own country men, so the nationality principle, and then also if there were victims from other countries, then these countries can also prosecute it. And the last thing is the universality principle, which is, as you may know, hotly debated, but basically if these massacres amount to a crime against humanity, then every state can exercise jurisdiction if they have national laws that permits them to do so. On an international level, that may be possible, maybe under certain restrictions, but this is possible. So there could be criminal prosecutions, for example, in Germany.
Thank you all, the panelists, and I'll take responsibility for the delays that occurred. But thank you once more for your attention. I think it was very important message and information we got. And we'll now have a break.